So yes, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to another Rugby Muscle podcast. Today, always happy to be joined by my man, Dr. James Hoffman. If you haven't heard of James, you should go back and listen to the other podcasts we've done with him because they were great. He's a former rugby player himself, authored several books, Scientific Principles of Strength Training, Recovering from Training, I think it's called. Great name. How Much Should I Train? Also a great name. And then recently, the Scientific Principles of Hypertrophy. All just fantastic resources. Have I missed out? I'm sure I've missed out one. I remember actually seeing one recently.
I can't even remember all of them. And thank you very much. Very flattering. Please go on. You know, we have a problem at RP. We have the worst. We start with the worst name titles for all of our books. It's usually diet book, training book, recovery book. And we kind of, and then marketing comes in and they're like, you know, we should probably think of a better name for that book.
And then it's like, it's too late at that stage. You're just like, like, can we just get it out? We've spent so much time actually writing the book.
Yes. They hammer us all the time. Like, you guys got to come up with better names. These suck.
But I mean, I think that like sort of is perfect in terms of like what you actually do anyway, because it's not like there's nothing in the books themselves that are either overhyped or revolutionary or anything. It's just like putting a consistent sort of systemized thought to everything, and you know, which actually explains it better than anyone else ever could, I think.
Well, thanks. That's kind of the goal. So, you know, like Mike and I, we are academics at heart, but our goal is not to necessarily be academics in the sense of we're not trying to publish papers and do studies and do that stuff. Our job is kind of to disseminate some of the hard to understand literature into digestible forms for everybody else and give them something practical and easy to use and apply to all their different situations. So hopefully we're doing a good job.
Yeah, I think, well, isn't that an Einstein quote? Like, if you can, you have to explain something to a 10-year-old and that's the only time that you realize you can prove you can actually understand it yourself.
Yeah, so. Yes, exactly. I used to tell my students something very similar when I was teaching. I'd say, you know, if you're having trouble with something, think of how you would explain it to like your mom who knows nothing about exercise science, right? Or exercise physiology. Like, how would you explain this concept to like your grandma who probably doesn't give a shit and doesn't know anything what you're talking about? Work on that. And that's a good practice tool.
Yeah, I do the same with when I consult with coaches and, you know, that actually coach athletes. I'm like, you can't be telling people, you know, about force vector stuff and using all this jargon. I can't think of any jargon off the top of my head, but using all this jargon that people love to use to show how smart they are. Like, you can explain it so simply and have them then understand it and sort of train better.
So. Yeah, absolutely. So that's our goal. And hopefully we did an okay job with this new one on the hypertrophy book.
Oh, indeed you did. And that's actually kind of where I want to start, because I've read both the Scientific Principles of Strength Training and Hypertrophy Training, and I've noticed that they don't have any example programs at the end. And actually, I love that fact, because it sort of shows that, you know, principle one is specificity. So what's the point of just giving you this sample program? Because I've been guilty of it myself. When I've bought a, you know, a 400 page book, I just flip to the last 20 pages that are sample programs and just go straight to them and do them.
Yes.
So do you want to talk a little bit about like why you didn't do that? Why you just, or was that even a thought to put some sample programs in there?
It's always a question. It's something that we feel very passionately about, and we always get a little bit of pushback on it, but I think we come at it from a good place in that the first issue is, right, everybody's different. There's no point in writing a sample program for a book, something as complicated as hypertrophy, because what people are generally going to do is just try and copy and paste exactly what you write down. But that doesn't take into account any specificity, any individualization, right? So, I mean, you're basically just mimicking something without any putting any real thought or effort into the process, which is what the book is trying to teach you, the process of setting up your own training to meet your goals, not just copying something else. So in the book, we do have a couple like sample progressions, and that's just looking at different exercises, intensities, volumes, and frequencies of how they might progress across like a mesocycle. But we deliberately never give any examples for that explicit reason, in that everybody's a little bit different. Everybody's going to have different wants and needs. Everybody's going to have different responses, different SFRs, et cetera. So there's really no point in putting a sample program down in that sense. The other problem that we run into is, this is going to sound maybe a little bit conceited on my part, but people tend to take anything that we say and just lock into it and say, why did you do close grip bench on this day followed by, you know, cable triceps. And then on a different day, you did pec flies, but you didn't do any tries, you know, stuff like, just like total nitpicky, weird stuff. People will just latch onto it. And then we get 1,000 questions. So one of the things we like to, Mike actually made a really brilliant Instagram post about this a long time ago, and I'm going to just steal it from him. He uses the example of saying pasta or rice, right? So when you're making carbs for yourself, would you rather have some pasta or some rice? It's virtually the same in terms of like macro micronutrient content. That, you know, if you do the macros, it's the same macros, you know, it's the same effect. It's 50 grams of carbs. Which one do you want, pasta or rice? That's the issue, right? We just picked ones that we thought were good because we liked it. It doesn't matter if you choose pasta or rice, right? That's up to you. It has little to no effect. And that's the kind of the problem that we run into when we actually write things down explicitly, where we say, all right, on this day, you should always do, you know, horizontal push. And people are like, why do you always do flat? It's like, you don't have to do that. You can do whatever you see fit within the boundaries of these principles that we're laying out for you. So that is a reason why we just, I think it encourages the kind of the wrong thought process, which is like copy and paste instead of thinking your way through it and trial and error and monitoring things that you do and making changes and auto-regulating along the way. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. Not just like, oh, here's the program Mike and James did. This is going to be the best one. And it's like, how could it be the best one for anybody? You got a huge spectrum of beginners to advanced. You got people who have different needs, asymmetries, different training age. You know, it's just like, there's no way you can write sample programs to meet everybody's needs.
It is so funny that it's kind of like people come at it from a flawed perspective, because they, when you first go into a gym, you get a program, you don't get really taught why that program is, and then everything sort of then expands upon from there. You don't get a map, you get a place, and then you're told to figure everything out, and you don't see the map ever. You just keep wandering around and around, and I don't know. You nailed it, and it's unfortunate because I get so many questions about people thinking that, like, from a, like, they say, oh, what is better, push pull legs or full body? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, it's or should I train 3 or 4 days a week? I don't know. Or whatever. There's so many different things, and
I think too, like, you and I have a similar background in that we've been involved in athletics and coaching athletics. And I think in that sense, it's more common to lay out a program where you say, like, this is the stuff that we're doing this week. And even then, I feel kind of reluctant to do that, because, like, even in sports, it's like, okay, these teams practice on this day, these teams practice on these other days. How can you write a sample program, right? It's like, it's hard to do that. And in the strength conditioning and sporting world, I feel like it's easier to give sample programs, because they just tend to be more constrained by specificity and compared to hypertrophy training, right? Yeah. So it's like, what do you need to do to be a good rugby player, soccer player, lacrosse player? Well, they tend to overlap quite a bit. There's not going to be a huge spectrum of different, you know, volumes and intensities that you're going to be hitting. So it's a little easier to say, like, okay, you know, you're probably going to have like a push-pull kind of breakdown. If you're doing 4 days a week, it might look like this. That's easier. But with hypertrophy training, it's literally like you are the Bob Ross of your world in this regard. You can just paint that fucking picture however you want it to be, and you can have all the happy little accidents you want. Like, that's what hypertrophy training is.
Yeah, it's funny with hypertrophy training. The amount of times people ask me, like, what do I need to do? And I'm like, whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter where you start. It matters what you do after that first week. And then you sort of go from there. But I think what does matter for athletes in general is something that gets overlooked so much. And that's starting out with their specificity. So that's like the number one principle you guys refer to, because it is everything. It is why you are training. You're in the gym to get an effect, and most people don't even recognize that. So how do athletes, especially like rugby players, I guess, that are listening to this, how would they go about figuring out what their, like, what that specificity is? Like, why are they in the gym?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a really important tool called a needs analysis, and I have been pitching this for a long time, and I have good news in that the book that I'm working on, which really outlines a lot of what this process is finally in the RP pipeline. Nice. My God, it's been like 3 years. So
that means it'll be out in about 5 years' time, right?
Exactly. I think their tentative release date is going to be probably either late June-ish.
Oh, nice.
Because it's largely written. It's just kind of needs a little tuning up. So, but anyways, the The first step is developing a needs analysis. And what that is you take a look at the sport itself and you say, what are the key performance indices of this sport? And that can include areas of fitness, skills, and tactics, right? So rugby is a great example. What do you need to be a great rugby player? Well, whether you play 15s or 7s, there's some pretty big commonalities. Typically, strength, power, short distance acceleration, and repeated high intensity intermittent endurance, right? So being able to burst, stop, and keep going for a long time. Those seem to, in terms of fitness, have the probably the biggest payouts in rugby. And then we can look at, well, what groups do you play in? Do you play in men's? Do you play in women's? Do you play in youth? Do you play in, you know, university? Do you play semi-pro? Or do you play at, you know, national level, right? And then we can look at those groups and we can look at our individual athletes and say, I'm looking at this yo-yo IR2 test, or I'm looking at this 1RM squat, or I'm looking at this, you know, vertical jump. Where does my athlete fall within a group of his peers or her peers in their competition group, right? And we say, okay, well, for some of these things, you're right on where you should be. And then maybe for some, you're actually way above. Maybe you're a lot stronger, maybe like 2 standard deviations stronger than the average person that you're competing against. But there is something that you kind of suck at, right? Which is like maybe you're repeated sprintability is not very good. And that's something where you can make a case. Now, it's not always a cut and dry thing of like, you are strong at this, you are weak at this. That means train what you're weak at. That is kind of a common one that we use. But you can look at these things and say, how do these things factor in? Which of these things do I want to cultivate? And which of these things are potentially holding me back from higher levels of performance? Mm-hmm. So typically we're just talking about fitness. We haven't even gotten into skills and tactics yet, right? So we can also look at, can you pass and catch? Can you ruck? Can you tackle? Do you make errors, right? Can you move on the fly? Can you make good decisions? Can you read the field, right? Like some of these things are hard to measure and assess, but we can look at all these different fitness skills and tactics. We can say, which of these things are the most important, right? Narrow it down. And then from that, we say, how does my athlete fall within all these categories? And then is there any glaring deficiencies? Is there something that is absolutely holding my athlete back from higher levels of performance? And are there things that are strengths that we should cultivate? So for example, in the case of rugby, you might have a forward who is way stronger than everybody else. And that's going to translate into better scrum performances, better tackles, rucks, tackle breaks, things like that. Potentially might even translate into more power and speed down the road if it's, you know, face potentiated. So that might be something where if you have a forward, you go, wow, this guy's actually gotten a lot of success just by being a strong motherfucker. Doesn't mean that we should stop training strength. Maybe we should cultivate that and see how far it goes. A great example of that in rugby, I think, is Carlin Isles, who's just fucking faster than everyone else, yes. Right? Does that mean that he should stop training speed? No, he can literally just fucking run around people because he's so fast and they just can't catch him. That's an example where you might look at a needs analysis and you say, well, he's faster than everyone else. We don't really need to train speed anymore. Maybe not. Maybe that's something that we cultivate and we say, you know, that's actually what's probably making you the best rugby player right now. And maybe at the same time, we address some of your weaknesses, but let's cultivate some of those strengths too. That's not a bad idea. And so it all starts from that needs analysis. And you look at these things and you say, you develop short and long-term strategies. You say, these things are holding me back. These things are kind of okay. And then these things I'm good at. And then you can go through your training program and say, I might deprioritize some things and really prioritize other things at certain times throughout the year to accommodate these exact strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that about Carlin Isles because we've recently done a reaction video to some of his training highlights, and go figure, the fastest rugby player in the world does a shit ton of sprinting, because I feel like it's something that we mentioned to like our athletes that are doing it, like a needs analysis. So is sometimes, yes, you are good in one area, but that sometimes you can double down and make yourself, that's your thing to stand out. So like, yeah, you said the strength, you could be just the absolute tank. Or Carlin Isles is actually the perfect example to use, because yeah, he's faster than everyone. But if he slows down and is only just a little bit faster than everyone else, he doesn't make the USA 7 squad. He doesn't become a successful rugby player. Yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly. And so it's like, should you spend a lot more time working on like fundamental skills? Like, maybe not. If it means he's going to slow down and not be able to perform at the level he currently is, then that's probably a net negative in terms of training, right? Whereas like, you could just bring up some of his basic skills to the point where they don't suck, right? So he's like, okay, at the bottom end of okay. Mm-hmm. And now he can still run past everyone and he doesn't have as many errors. Great. Go. Yep. Those are the exact situations we want to look at.
Yeah. It's like you're doing, you know, I use the analogy of like, you're using a creator character and you haven't got infinite amounts of points. You want to allocate your training resources to the certain points, right? And I say sometimes it's just, how do you want, especially for amateur athletes, which is 99% of the people I'm dealing with, like, how do you want to play the game? How is the game going to be more fun for you? Which characteristics do you want to develop? Do you want, like, you know, don't just say you want to be a strong guy if you're a winger that, like, loves going around the outside of people. Like, that's absolutely fine.
On that note, let me, I have a pet peeve, and I'm confident you share this with me.
Good.
When you have people who are relatively new, and I don't mean to condescend in any way, but you got guys who have been playing, you know, whatever sport, let's just use rugby because that's a commonality between us, but you got guys playing 1 or 2 years, and they're already telling you about how they want to play. Like, motherfucker, you don't know how to play yet. Don't tell me that you want to play like these tactics, these skills, these fitness. Like, you just got to go out there, learn, experiment with some different styles, try some things and see where it goes. And by the time you got like 4 or 5 years under your belt, you'll have a pretty good idea of where you are and what you can do. But when you're a beginner, like, slow your roll, homie. Don't tell me that you want to be like the Tank or the Carl Niles or any of the other things. Like, you just got to get your feet wet, get some experience, see where you are, see where you, how you match up with your peers, and see where your teammates are and go from there.
What you've got there is a overuse of specificity, right? It's like,
yeah.
And we get it. You get it with the hypertrophy book, where, and I get it with like younger athletes, where they're like, how do I, you know, it's a 17-year-old, like, how do I have a lock specific workout? And it's like, just get bigger. Like, that's it, you know? And it's like, oh, how do I improve my upper chest? And I'm sure I've heard of Dr. Mike rant, you know, you don't have any chest, just get more chest. Like,
you get more chest. Exactly.
Yeah. You don't have to over analyze. And sometimes I feel like it's very easy for people to do that. And you want to find that middle point, which, I guess if we go back to the needs analysis, I noticed you said a lot of like lifts and or different testing methods that we would compare to others. What if an athlete doesn't have access to any of those things? Like, is there a simpler way that they can break it down and still do a needs analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. So you don't need to, like, a lot of fancy laboratory equipment. Like, even something like doing a jump height, you can do with like a piece of chalk and a wall. Like, it's not the best way to do it, but yeah, you can do it and you can measure progress, right? Do you need to do 1RM testing to know how strong you are? No. If you're doing like sets of 5 in the gym, like, you got a pretty good idea of how strong you're going to be. Yes. And you can just monitor those things over time, right? Do you have a stopwatch and like a tape measure? Okay. You can do a 20 meter sprint. Like, that's not a lot of equipment. It's pretty easy to set up. And if you have if you have a track or something available in your neighborhood, or if you're a collegiate athlete, like, sometimes they're already marked out and you don't have to do much. Yeah. So those are all just like really basic things. And it turns out like some of the most basic things have some of the greatest carryover. And this is true of not just rugby, but like most strength and power sports, where it's like, what are the things that are going to make you better more often than not? If I'm a betting man, I'm going to say, make your athlete stronger, make them more powerful, make them faster. And in the case of, you know, intermittent sports, like, train the high intensity endurance that they need to do for that particular sport, which is going to be different for each one. But that's like 85% of sports. You know what I mean? Then you have kind of like the pure sports. You have like your track and field kind of sports and your endurance sports, which make up the other chunk. But the rest of them are all pretty much that. And then how you get there has some specificity constraints. But I mean, the overlap is significant, right? So that's the beauty of a lot of strength conditioning stuff, where you can make it complicated, sure, but a lot of the fundamental stuff, like what's going to make my athlete better, is stuff that they can do and they don't need a lot of equipment to do it. If you have a gym, you can do it.
I want to go back to that point, but I do want to piggyback off of what you just said there in terms of like the strength and conditioning being so simple. I do find that like strength and conditioning now, unfortunately, is like a marketing term, just like everything else. And like people now, if they see strength and condition, they're expecting power cleans. They're expecting wads at this point now, where, you know, I want to feel like I'm on a rugby pitch. And it's like, why? Like, go play rugby to feel like you're on a rugby pitch. If you're in the gym, why are you in the gym? What's the actual purpose? And go do that. And it's like,
yes,
it's one of my pet peeves. And I think it's because people are selling strength and conditioning classes. And I'm like, well, if you're just selling, what is, like, if you can't outline exactly what you're trying to improve for strength and conditioning, then you are just using it as a marketing term. And people like to feel like they're athletic. I think that's more, if anything, people are relying on their feelings too much.
Yeah, totally. I think it's all marketing, and I think people are just willing to pay for kind of like a, for lack of a better term, a ball busting kind of workout. They want to just walk out of there and feel like they got their nuts busted, and they're sweating, and they're out of breath, and they're like, "Wow, that's, I feel like I really put in some effort today." And that's, you know, no shame in that that mentality, but you can do that same effort in a more structured and meaningful and impactful way just by doing some really basic ass strength training, some really fundamental like power and speed development stuff. And big surprise, get your ass on the pitch and play whatever sport that you're doing, homie. That's going to be a big one.
Yeah. It's become a real pain point of mine. Like just how strength and conditioning is now being sort of sold to be something that's a lot more complicated. And now, you know, people don't go back to it, but I want to go back to the, cause I think people want to feel like they've had that workout, and they want it. Like, that's why Metcons are so popular, because it feels like you're really, but I always say like, well, that's not what you do in rugby. Like if you were just to do 30 minutes of tempos, you'd be nowhere near as tired, but you'd be better. I'd always choose to be better.
It's hard to kind of convey that idea of specificity, especially, and it gets complicated, right, when you get into like energy systems trainings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But like the really fundamental example is just like, okay, like you can look at like just basic kinematics on the rugby field. Like, how often are you in motion? How often are you at rest? Like, how fast do you move? How do you move, right? Can you mimic those things? Like, that's a really simple way. It's like, yes, more often than not, you're going to be running, stopping, running, stopping, changing direction, doing the same thing over and over again. That's rugby right there. And every now and again, there's a ball and you pick it up or you kick it. Like, you can work on that too. But for conditioning, like, you have the really brilliant thing about some of the research on high intensity interval training, what they found is they've looked at small sided games, and they found that you get the same conditioning stimulus of doing small sided games in practice as if you did like tempos or hit kind of running intervals anyway. Mm-hmm. So you get the same training stimulus for the conditioning while working on the skills and tactics of your sport with the ball in your hand and doing the things you're supposed to do. So it's like a very time efficient way of training. And I have a very hard time when people say like, well, what about doing Metcons? It's like, well, what are you getting out of that? Are you getting stronger? No, because you're using weights that you can fling around for reps of 30. Are you getting more explosive? No, because your force velocity is all over the place because you're using really light loads and you're just getting really fatigued the whole time. Are you getting more conditioning? Like, yeah, a little bit, but it doesn't have a much specific carryover to the activity that you're actually going to be doing. So why are you doing it? You're just getting tired for no reason.
Because people, yeah, it's an emotional attachment. People like to feel like they've done something. And I want to sort of expand upon that, because I think how people feel is so subjective. But I do think that there's a place for it with when we do these needs analysis. I've started to really sort of think deeply about how I program my training and what I do for my athletes. And I've gone further and further away from doing like any testing, rather than like, I just say, right, you know how you're playing the game. Your coaches know how you're playing the game. Like, where do they say that you might need to improve? And sometimes, I mean, do you think that there's any sort of weakness in looking at a needs analysis that way? Just as simple as like, what are the areas that you think you need to work on? Or what are the areas that your coach thinks that you need to work on?
Yeah, so I do think that the notion of sometimes less is more when it comes to testing is good, because testing takes up a lot of time and effort, and it's often just as disruptive for the athlete themselves. Mm-hmm. But the problem that you run into by doing like minimalist testing is like you can't assess what you don't measure, right? And so you can kind of guess and say like, I think things are going well, but can you definitively state like, my athlete is improving in the area of fitness, and that is translating over to improvements on the pitch. So if you don't do some kind of testing, you can't necessarily state that confidently. Now, does the testing that you do need to be overly complicated? No, that's the other thing, right? So if you're keeping good records of things like their lifting numbers, like you don't have to have them come in and do 1, 3, or 5 RMs, right? That's just a big waste of their time. You can just monitor like, what did they do for fives at 80, 8.5 RPE last time? Well, they did 100 kilos. What did they do this time? They did 105 kilos. Well, pretty fair to say they probably got stronger, and that's great. You know, things like that go a long way. I do think, though, that you do have to have within your athlete groups some type of happy balance where you are doing some periodic assessments, where you are looking at the things every now and again. Maybe it's like twice a year. Maybe it's like 4 times a year. If you work for like a collegiate football team and you have infinity resources, by that I mean American football, you might have testing, you know, some kind of testing stuff being done like every month, and hopefully it's non-invasive. The coach and the athlete have to kind of work that out themselves and figure out, like, how often should I assess? What's the least invasive to your schedule? And what's the most impactful for me to make meaningful changes? Because what you don't want to be in a position is you're finding out that what you're doing is not working the way that you want. You just have no idea, and you let it cruise for a really long time. And by the time that you figure out, like, this isn't really doing what I hoped it was doing, it's too late. They've already had like a couple really shitty performances. Now you have to start making those changes later on. So there's a balance that you have to strike. There's no right or wrong answer there. I'm not going to say that you have to do it once a year, twice a year, three times a year, four times a year. Somewhere in there, though, you have to make some assessments, and those assessments should guide meaningful changes to the training.
So as far as like, I use the argument that like I'm using your training as almost a testing, right? That's the feedback. Like you said, if you've started out with 100 kilos for sets of five at the beginning of a block, and at the end of a block you're using 110 kilos or 115 kilos, then, you know, you've made X amount of progression. But the argument against that, I imagine, would be then that there could be some weak points that you're missing as they slowly slide down and get worse and worse and worse.
Or might not. So like strength is kind of an easy one to do in like a non-formal way, right? Whereas other ones might be more complicated, like doing the intermittent endurance, doing like the sprinting, jumping kind of stuff. Those things might be worth doing like a quick, like, okay, we're going to do our warm up for this today's session. I'm going to have you take three jumps on this, either like a vertec or whatever. And that's it. It's only going to take 10 minutes. And then we'll move on with the training session. Something like that's pretty non-invasive and is pretty useful for monitoring some things. So I do think that it can be kind of fussy. That's the problem that you run into, where it gets like, how much time and fuss do I want to put into this stuff? And what is the payout of doing the fuss and taking the athlete out of just being focused on the training that they're doing? And there's no right or wrong answer there. That's something that people just kind of have to figure out and have a good rapport with each other.
I find that with that, it's like, especially with rugby, where you get a lot of rugby seasons that run, you know, 8+ months long. And so, you know, to use the game as a test. Yes, you know, games are always going to be completely unpredictable by nature. It's very difficult to judge a game by game. But in general, like, if someone's put on some speed over the course of the 8 months, that should show itself at some point in a game, and you should be able to feel that.
Yeah, and so that might be something where you just take it like for a season at a time, where you say like, okay, this season we can look at some of your like average stats and say, okay, you moved this much on average, or you had this many tries or this many whatever's tackle breaks. And if you have – and like a lot of people even have GPS now, so you can look at some of their kinematic stuff and say like, on average, you moved this many meters per game or had this many accelerations. And like, that's an easy one you can just look at once per season. You don't have to look at it every fucking game, because then you're just going to drive yourself mad doing the assessment. So I think that's one where you just kind of look at it on a bigger time scale. You kind of look at some averages and say, like, on average, are they making some small improvements over time? And yeah, okay, boom, not too bad.
Yeah, I think that is what people – I mean, it's what people get, I think, a bit messed up too much with their training, is that they look so much for, like, this – how to perfect their week-to-week progression. And then they just toss it out after a month or so, and they don't look at their year-to-year progression, you know? Whereas, like, if you look back sometimes – like, I've had athletes that, you know, they're like, oh, you know, I haven't lost as much body fat this week, or my strength – and I'm like – so what I'll do is, like, this is the beauty of me keeping people's training. Like, I've got a log of a year ago, and I'm like, look how much you've improved. Like, it's so easy. Like, and this is now a bad week for you where you're still doing this. So I think a lot of people don't ever look back over their training. And I guess that was a question I already had lined up for you, is like, how important do you think reviewing, you know, your training over the short term and over the long term is for athletes? And how much of it do you do yourself?
Yeah, so I think the same is kind of true for both hypertrophy training people and athletes in general. Like, tediously reviewing like week to week performance is just a waste of time. Like, it's good to keep those logs, and it's good to be diligent about just writing them down and saying like, okay, you know, this week my RIR was 2 and I did this many reps at this many weight. That's perfectly fine. And that's just something you write down, and maybe you don't look at again for a very long time, right? Perfect. Same thing with athletes. Like, one of the things that drives me nuts with the week to week performance people is people who really rely on like the velocity tracking systems. I'm like, this is madness. This is madness. You literally have to have like a year's worth of force velocity curves to even know where the athlete should be at any given load or repetition range to know if it's like in a good spot or a bad spot. Like, this is craziness. Don't bother doing that stuff. But I do think, so this is kind of my stance, and take it or leave it. My colleagues and I tend to break down kind of what we call testing and monitoring. And testing is like what you would imagine when athletes come into the lab and they jump on force plates and they do like a treadmill test or a yo-yo test or something like that. And you get like very precise and reliable data. And that is something you do maybe 0 to 2 times a year, right? 2 times being, that's like a lot. Most athletes will do that maybe like once or twice a year. Monitoring is exactly what you're talking about, where you're trying to pull numbers just from the stuff that they're already doing, right? So monitoring is like keeping good workout logs, keeping logs of your performances, like whether it's skill, fitness, tactics, data on your actual performances. Like if you can keep some really basic logs, you have a very good idea of where your athlete is trending at any given time. And it doesn't require you to make extra trips to labs, make extra trips for testing, get pumped up and do maximal effort stuff. All you got to do is keep a fucking log of what happened. And you have a pretty good idea of what's going on. So what we tend to recommend is like do testing, you know, very rarely, but you should be monitoring almost all the time. And you should be able to look back at your training logs at any given time and say, okay, like last time I did a strength block, you know, where was I? And then you say, okay, well, this time I'm here. Like, great. Last time I did a sprint, like how fast did I do 20 meters? Okay, it was this time. Now I did this time. Okay, great. And I'm pretty close to what I did, or maybe even a little bit better. That stuff is free. And it doesn't require a lot of effort. You just got to write the shit down and put it in a spreadsheet or whatever. That's it. So generally recommend that you should have a good monitoring program where you're just logging whatever it is that you're doing. It doesn't mean that you're tediously going back and looking at every day and saying like, oh, no. It's just keep good records so that when you want to go back and look at it and analyze it, if you choose to, you can. If you don't, you can't make any assessment. So that goes back to that idea, right? You can't assess what you don't measure. And in this case, monitoring, all you got to do is just write it down. That's it. Beautiful. And that covers your basis for a lot of training.
Yeah, I've sort of shoehorned my own narrative in here, I think, because I've gone so far I've never put it as eloquently as you do. I mean, that's why you write so many bloody books, I guess. But like, that's exactly what it is. I'm a huge fan of. I don't see the need for testing once you've got, you know, if you've got a good quality monitoring process. Yeah, maybe every now and again you can run a test, but I think the reason people love to run tests is because they don't do any monitoring, so they never know really week to week if they're getting stronger or if they're getting better or whatever, because they just turn up to a gym and go, right, it's chest day, and then they go from there.
I think too, like, the testing, it's different when you work kind of in like the public and private sectors. Like when you work for like a university team, the coaching staff and the athletic staff, they have complete control over what those athletes do. And if they don't comply, they're gone, right? So it's like, if you actually want to do that stuff, you have the resources to do that stuff relatively easily. Whereas in the private sector, you know, you kind of get a mixed bag of people's motivations to want or be comply with doing some of that stuff, or even are able to do some of that stuff. And that's where monitoring is brilliant, because you don't need to.
And that's kind of, I think that's also what I've come to the conclusion of, is like a lot of programs, a lot of strength and conditioning coaches, like they do the testing because they've got to keep their job, because the actual football coach or the head rugby coach or whatever, it happens a lot at rugby S&C as well, you know, they run a pointless fucking test and then they say, right, you've got to do your strength and conditioning to show that they're all getting better. And it's like, it's just such a waste of, you know, especially if you do a test, and this is the worst that people do, and we'll get back to not moaning about testing in a second, but it's when people do testing at the very beginning of preseason. And I know clubs are going to go back to when they come back to training after all this time off, like a year out of training consistently, you know, and they're going to go back to training week one. And I'm like, oh, so many people are just going to get hurt and waste a week. Like, that's a week of quality training they could have done that they're wasting now by doing testing. Half the time, these coaches don't even retest at any point after that anyway, because they realize they've got to train. They can't sacrifice another week. And so I feel like, you know, even no matter what environment, I feel like if you get a good monitoring system in place, like that takes care of most things. Hi, guys. I just wanted to jump in here to tell you that if you're enjoying this podcast and you want to become a better athlete, then you can go ahead and visit rugby-muscle.com and pick up any of our free goodies. That is the 50 free rugby conditioning sessions, the physique nutrition crash course video series, the supplement guide, and newly added is a macro calculator. Yes, that's right. A macro calculator where you will be able to work out your protein, carbs, fat, and calories that you should be eating on a daily basis to give you a guide as to where to start your diet from. This will help in conjunction with your 50 free conditioning sessions to build you out a decent little plan that will enable you to take control of your training and use effective training and nutrition to become a better athlete. All that stuff and more can be found at rugby-muscle.com or rugby-muscle.com/macros for the macro breakdown.
Yeah, and I'm actually on your side here, but just to be devil's advocate, and I don't know how it is in other places, but I know here in the United States, typically when teams don't do well, the first person on the chopping block is the strength conditioning coach. Mm-hmm. So I think they are incentivized in a way to do the testing and do it somewhat regularly so they can say, hey, it's not me. Look at athletes are getting stronger. They're jumping higher. They're more enduring. So like they're getting better on my end. So on that side, I get it. I don't necessarily think that that's the best way to go about it, but I understand at least from like a self-preservation standpoint, why they might choose to do that.
Yeah. And then those are the guys that are in, you know, they're leading the strength and conditioning field. So then we've got guys that are nowhere near that, you know, sort of context, like amateur athletes, amateur rugby players, and they're looking at like, right, what do I need to do to improve? Oh, I've got to do this test before I even get started. And I don't know.
And that's the thing, like the test that you should, and what we can move on, but you know, I'm a big advocate, like you should do testing, but the test that you should be meaningful. Like you shouldn't just do a bunch of bullshit tests that make no sense. Like if you're doing sit and reach just for the sake of saying you did a flexibility test that has no outcomes on the training that you're doing, what the fuck are you doing? Right? Like same thing, like I see this all the time. I'm sure you see it all the time. I remember one of the times I was an undergraduate at University of Illinois in Chicago, and I had the great pleasure to work with the Chicago Blackhawks, the hockey team. And I remember we would go into their testing sessions, and they would do like 2 hours of S&C testing, and then they would take a break and then do 2 hours of like ice testing, like so on the ice. And I remember I was talking to the strength coach, and I was like, why do you do all of these tests? Like, do you actually change their programming based on the test results? And he goes, no. And then he kind of looked at me and was like, you know, I think we're doing probably too many tests. And I was like, I was like an undergrad too. So I was like, did I just fuck up? Did I ask a bad question? What happened?
You thought about it.
Yeah. And the next year we came back and it was like half as many tests, because I think he just had that epiphany of like, I've been doing it this way for a long time and it's a big waste of my time. It's a big waste of their time. Maybe I'll just pick a few tests that are actually meaningful. That's the way you do it. Like, use something where you can say, I need to change my training based on this test that I did. If it doesn't, if you pick a test that never results in that, it's probably a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we started talking about testing in the first place. It's like you said, it's a part of the needs analysis. It's literally the entire reason you're doing it. And it's so often that it just doesn't happen. But I think it's just something that is done because it's always done, and that's how people do it. And I think that's the same thing with exercise selection, which is where I wanted to ask you next, is like people get married to different exercises, like, I've got to do a power clean, like I said earlier, because it's strength and conditioning. They think about they've got to do an Olympic lift or they've got a bench press or whatever. And what you've outlined so well in the, especially in the hypertrophy book, but I'm sure you've outlined it before, it's like you need to put exercises into categories. But with that being said, like how long with this monitoring system, I guess you've got some sort of way of being able to figure out which exercise works well using SFRs and whatnot. So how would you go about testing whether an exercise is suitable or not for any given athlete?
Yeah. So I think this is like kind of a diverging point between like training purely for hypertrophy or just physique purposes and training for athletic purposes. Right. So in like the hypertrophy sense, you have a lot more freedom to swap exercises in and out as soon as you really feel like they're kind of going flat on you. And when we say going flat, it usually means like you don't get a big pump from doing them. You don't get a lot of disruption. Like you don't feel soreness. Like, you know, when you have a really good dialed in exercise, like stiff legged deadlifts is the classic example. Like when you really dial in your stiff legged deadlifts, you can't fucking sit down. You can't take a shit. You can't do anything, right? Because it messes you up in the right ways. So you find exercises, right? Like if you've been doing one for a while and you don't have that problem where like, yeah, I guess I could sit down and take a shit pretty comfortably. I don't really feel sore. I don't feel like I'm going to collapse. I don't really feel a pump in my hamstrings or my glutes anymore. That's usually, and then kind of the other kind of more technical answer is when your MEV starts to climb very, very high, right? So what that means is like to get any semblance of those aforementioned things like pumps, soreness, if you get any of that, you have to start doing like 5, 6, 7 sets of the exercise before you even start feeling that, right? That's where we say that exercise has gone flat. It's gone stale on you and it's time to swap it out. Because let's say you were doing stiff-legged deadlifts as an example. Now you're up to like 5 or 6 sets and you're kind of like, I'm not really feeling this one that much anymore. All of a sudden you switch to like high bar good mornings for the next mezzo. And you do 2 sets and you get that same disruption that you were getting before. You are now wrecked. You cannot sit down. Your hamstrings are sore, right? And you got that same stimulus just from doing like 2 sets. And you got the pumps and everything else that came with it. So in hypertrophy training, you kind of have a lot of flexibility to swap exercises in and out based on how they feel and how your individual response is to them. So classic example is like some people can do a lot of bench. Some people can't. And like you say, okay, well, if you've been doing a lot of bench and not making a lot of progress, have you tried doing any flies or any kind of like cable flies or dumbbell flies? And they're like, no. And you're like, okay, I'll try that. And they're like, oh my fucking God, I've never felt like a stretch, a pump, like anything like that in my chest before. And you go, well, congrats, you found like a good SFR movement for your chest. Do that for a little while and see how it goes. The problem you run into is when you kind of take that idea and you want to translate it over to sports, because although that same sentiment does apply, the specificity constraint of most sports is much harder, meaning like you might have somebody who is like very responsive to like, let's look at like a quad movement. So like leg press, for example, they might be like, leg press just feels so good for me, right? If you had somebody who is like a really, really good high bar squatter versus somebody who's a really good leg presser, who are you going to put your money on, mm-hmm. on that rugby pitch? More often than not, it's going to be the squatter. Why? Well, that movement just tends to have a lot better carryover in terms of transfer of training effects. Why? Because it's like a whole kinetic chain movement. You have to support your body weight. You have to actually interact with the ground in a more similar way than being propped up on a leg press. So there's kind of like, I don't know how to say this the right way. So like in bodybuilding, in like physique training, everything's kind of relative. Like, how does it feel for you? Right? Does this feel good? Is it working? Okay, great. In sport training, you kind of have more of an absolute problem. Like you are simply too weak or slow or not enduring enough. And sometimes that means you have to choose exercises that are maybe not the highest SFR in terms of like growth or personal preference, but they just get you going in the direction that you need to go. For example, another good one might be like doing a goblet squat versus a high bar squat. And I'm just using the squat because it's like probably the best example of this in terms of like exercises that carry over better than most others. Like the goblet squat is one like, yeah, you could get like really good pumps and soreness and stuff from doing it, but how much load are you actually using? You know, maybe like 50 kilos if you're pretty good at it. How much can you do with a barbell? Well over 100, if not more, for that same person. So the absolute amount of force that you're generating is just so much higher, and that's going to translate to just an absolute greater amount of strength and the transfer of training effects that come from that. So within that, we do have some room to kind of make good choices for our athlete. Like some people are just better built for some different exercise variations. So what I kind of like to think of it as terms of like, in terms of getting like stronger and more powerful, are you going to have, is it a problem if an athlete really feels good on a close grip bench, but they have to use a little bit less weight than a barbell bench? Is that a huge deal? Probably not. What is a big deal is if you substitute like a barbell movement exclusively for a dumbbell movement. In this case, you're sacrificing so much force output that you could be getting, right? In terms of specificity and carryover, like you need to be strong. Like, can you get stronger using dumbbells? Sure. Are you going to get stronger using barbells? Yes, even if you have a better kind of SFR feel for the dumbbells themselves. Does that make sense, or am I rambling like a crazy person?
No, I'm with you. It's like it's more about like your – with hypertrophy training, you've got muscle groups, right? And you're looking to train muscle groups however. Yeah, there's slightly different movement categories and ways to train them, you know, depend on the rep range and whatnot. But with athletic training, you've got a little bit more of a movement category. It's a little bit more – it's not as simplistic as, oh, you're trying to stimulate this muscle. No, you're trying to get X, Y, Z. Like you're trying, you know, the benefits are more than just one, right?
And you said it perfectly, right? So sport training is movement training, right? That's what you're training. Hypertrophy training is muscle training. You're training the muscles, right? And that's the big difference. So what you're trying to do is improve movements in sport training, which is just a slightly different thing. You just come at it from a slightly different angle.
Yeah, it's the same. It's a very similar end perspective, but the way you've reached those end perspectives are very, you've come about them are very different. And that's not to say that there are times within sport training where hypertrophy is the entire goal, you know? And so people sometimes tend to forget about that. And that's where we look at the specificity point, right? It's like, people are so quick to throw out leg presses versus squats, but if you're doing sets of 15 to 20, like, you're not doing that with squats without dying.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to poo-poo any of those exercises.
No, it's fine.
As like, in terms of specificity, we could say like if I'm putting bets on my athletes, and I have one group over here that uses like a lot of machines, and another group over here that uses a lot of free weights. In terms of sport outcomes, I'm leaning towards the free weight side.
Yeah, and you've got, I mean, then that's the thing. You've already, like, what you do is you're still looking at it from a group of exercises, but the group of exercises is a lot smaller. I guess from there, that makes me ask, like, how long would you give it before you take someone and you give up on an exercise? You know, say they are doing barbell back squats and they're 6'5", but their other buddy who's also 6'4", like, you know, he reps out sets of five like a champion on the squat. Whereas this guy's, he's fairly new to it. He's struggling with it. He says, look, I mean, you told me that, you know, this doesn't have a good SFR for me. Like, well, what point would you consider switching that out for that person? How long would you give an exercise before, I guess, just giving up on it rather than switching it out?
Yeah, I generally have a hard time giving up on something entirely, because what I have found more often than not, is that people often have to individualize their technique for an exercise. So you kind of coach someone, you learn the basics. How do I do a pretty good classic bench press or a squat, right? And they learn how to do it externally correctly, and everybody's happy. And then at that point, once they're kind of intermediate, now you say, I need you to actually tailor this to yourself a little bit more and say, like, do it in a way that you think you're getting the most out of this movement. So usually that's the issue, but that is not always the issue. And so there are times where you might abandon an exercise altogether. So what we find in like sport training is generally there's enough variation in the intensity at which you are training a movement that you don't have to swap them out a lot. That's why you typically don't see a huge variety. It's why most classic strength conditioning programs are pretty bare bones in terms of exercise selection, because you get so much variation from doing sets of 8 to sets of 5 to sets of 3s, and maybe even entertaining some, you know, 1 to 3s every now and again. That's enough variation to keep that exercise pretty fresh more often than not. But there are times where it can go just purely flat, where you're just not getting anything out of it anymore. And sometimes the athlete's just not built for it. They just, maybe it's anthropometry, whatever, their technique's not good. Any combination of those things, you might choose to give up on one. So generally what I would do is I would leave it in for an entire block of training. Or in this case, you might, if you're using more like periodization terms, you would leave it in for like an entire preparatory period and say, like, we're going to work on this. You're going to keep trying to get better, and you're going to build momentum on it. Because it's easy to give up on something when you stink at it and the technique's not good. But it's one of those things, like, once you can dial in the movement and you get good at it, you want to get that momentum, especially in the sporting world, because, again, most of the outcomes revolve around generating strength and power. And the way that you get stronger and more powerful is by having some baller fucking technique on your movements and carrying that momentum across different loading spectrums, right? That's how you get really good at some of those things. So I tend to not want to abandon them, but I would give it like an entire block or a preparatory period and say, like, we're going to work on your squats. You know, you're going to have your opportunity to do high reps, moderate reps, and low reps. And by the time, if you say, like, dude, this one sucks for me, it just doesn't work, you can start entertaining some alternatives. And those alternatives should be like just deviations, right? Like, if you had been doing just regular high bar squats, you can try a close stance squat or a front squat, or maybe even, I'm not a big fan of doing low bar squats in sports, but that's one that's out there. You could try it. I generally wouldn't go that route personally, but that's just me. Same thing with like your pressing variations too. You might have people who really suck at bench press, right? And maybe you try something else, maybe try an incline bench, try close grip bench. You might find that they're just a little bit better for that individual. But I sound cynical saying this, but I find that in the sporting world, you generally want to carry as much momentum on the movements that you're training as possible. So I would tend not to swap them out unless it was causing them injury. Like, dude, this exercise really is fucking up my elbows or my knees really bad. Can I get a different one? That's a situation where I'd say, yeah, let's swap that out. But if everything's good and they just don't like it, but they're making some progress, keep it in.
I think it's also an ego thing. Like if you're using a back squat as like a perfect example, like some people shouldn't be doing more than 200 pounds, and that's okay for everyone that knows what they're doing, except for that person, because it's a little shot to the ego because they're looking at other lifters and stuff. And it's funny, I got a few points to piggyback off of. The first one was like, I sort of had a bit of an epiphany there where you're talking about how with strength and conditioning, because the phasic nature of the training that we do and it is a lot different to hypertrophy training. So I think that you switch out exercises because you're switching out the objectives of each training block or each mesocycle, and therefore you get that. And it made me think about my training, where recently I did a 12-week hypertrophy sort of run, and I really thought, right, I'm going to take this really slowly. I'm going to progress really slowly, and I'm going to slowly progress and add sets over time. But I'm not going to deload. I'm going to try and see if I can just go 12 weeks without changing it out, because I want to just stick with this program. Yeah, I didn't last. I broke it down. I had to break it down because I'm just like, if anything, it just got stale, because the nature of my training has always been, every 4 to 6 weeks I'm switching it out anyway. And I think that's just sort of like the way I've always seen training, is like you have a real good 6 week run at like really progressing on an exercise, and then you switch it out. And even as I took my progression slowly, I'm like, I still got to switch these exercises out, even if I was keeping the rep ranges somewhat similar. But for the most part, yeah, you cover your exercise variation because you're applying actual periodization to your training. And the other one I was thinking about is, you said about, I don't even think about high bar or low bar unless I'm talking to power lifters where it's a difference. Like, I just say, put the bar on your back, get some tension, and squat.
So people love to use the low bar because it's for many people, it's the stronger variation. But God, the cost of like your shoulders and elbows and everything else in your back, it just fucks you up so bad that you can't do other stuff. So I try to avoid it as much as possible. But yeah. I agree.
I don't mind putting the bar fairly low on your back, but you still squat it like it's a high bar squat. Like, I think it's another one of those things where people love to overthink it. I don't know. But I guess that's, you sort of outline exactly why you would keep exercise in. I think it's something I've seen with training as well. It's like with this lockdown, I've said to people, this is a good time to just practice squatting without any weight. Like, when have you ever had the pressure taken off of you before, where you don't have to worry about adding weight to the bar or any, putting a weight or even having a bar on you? You can actually just eat, every rep you can do can be trying to get a better squat. And then when you get back to the gym, that would pay dividends. I think so many athletes are so fast to try and think that they're working strength that they forget that they're working movement. And I've seen so many athletes that just move poorly. And I think, at what point do you address movement versus the specificity of strength, hypertrophy, or power or whatnot?
I'm a bit of a stickler on this. So you take or leave my position, but movement is like usually the first thing. I usually work on technique, never progress in load volume until that tech. So I kind of I call it like an 85% rule. If the technique is like what I would consider to be 85% acceptable or better, we're good to go. We are training. Mm-hmm. Once we drop below what I would call like an 85% quality mark, that's when we have to backtrack a little bit and say either we're reducing the load in terms of trying to improve technique, or we're going to backtrack a little bit for the next week and we're going to start at a lighter load and make sure that that technique's crisp. But I usually don't like to find myself in that position, because I like to make sure that that technique is dialed in. And when I say technique, this is something kind of, I don't know, somewhat contentious, right? So the notion that there is no perfect technique for everybody is true, right? There are some external cues that we can all generally agree on, which would, cause us to say, like, this is a good looking high bar squat, this is a good looking bench press, this is a good looking deadlift, right? Most of it's around like posturing, you know, basic movement of the joints, things like that. Within that, once that is locked down in my, I know that I have an athlete and I say, you're going to go do deadlifts and I don't have to worry about them doing a poop dog, right? Mm-hmm. We're good to go. Then within that, once they kind of get intermediate at that intermediate training stage, then we say, you know, kind of individualize this technique a little bit to yourself. So I might ask you to start with your butt way down, almost like a squat kind of setup in a deadlift. And that's how I'm going to teach you how to do it. But then at some point, you might say, it's actually a little bit better. I get more out of this movement if I raise my butt up a little bit higher from the starting position that we have been training for a long time. Can I work on that a little bit? Yes, that's fine, as long as it's not breaking any of the major external constraints. So, fuck, what was – oh, we're talking about when do you decide movement training or periodization. Yeah, movement training always comes first. And in fact, and this is – again, take it or leave it. This is one of the reasons why I don't typically program a lot of the Olympic – lifts or their variations, because the amount of movement training required to get somebody going on that is a lot. It's a big investment in terms of the tech requirements. And you could make a strong case in saying, like, can they get pretty much a similar stimulus from doing something like a jump or a loaded jump or like a jump shrug kind of thing? And the answer is, yeah, probably. And that's a pretty quick and easy one to get going on. So there are athletes where I do work on those things. And usually I have the fortune of them having had some experience in that beforehand, and then they can kind of just come into it. But if I get a new athlete, we might work on some like pulls from mid thigh, kind of more or less like a, you know, jump shrug from mid thigh. And that might be like the only Olympic lift or variation on that we do for a long time, because you get the same benefit without all the movement investment in terms of practice. Cause it's like, you have an opportunity cost, right? Am I training them to be a rugby player, or am I training them to be a fucking weightlifter? Like, do they need to be able to do a snatch? No, they need to be able to like ruck, maul, kick, catch balls. Right. And they need to do it strong and powerfully. So can I get them to do like a jump shrug, get the same power output on those target muscles and get them going and good training right away? Yeah, absolutely. So you kind of have two perspectives on that, where like on some things I'll spend a lot of fucking time. We will drill squat technique till we can't do it anymore, right? But other things like Olympic lifts, like that's a big cost on my, in my opinion. And that's something I wouldn't spend a lot of time, and I just probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think it goes, especially with the Olympic lift. The reason you don't do it is because, you know, the movement isn't there. Like, and it's a waste of time to try and get the movement there. It's not a waste of time to try and get someone to squat well. Like, that's a basic movement pattern that people need to get down. I do a lot of stuff where it's just basic jumping, and people, like, sometimes, yeah, it seems so simplistic, but it's like no one trains this stuff at this basic level, and no one actually gets better at doing this stuff, because they quickly add weight, and then they get better at pointless weighted jumps, or they get better at moving inefficiently with more load. And it's like, no, like, break this movement down. Like, do every rep like it's a one rep max, but you're not being judged on how much weight you're lifting. You're being judged on how fucking perfect is that movement. Now, when you go back to doing the weights, you don't necessarily have to view it that way. You have to view it so that it is, you know, so someone looking at it from 10 meters away can say, yeah, that's a squat, or that's a deadlift, and they know what it is, you know? Whereas, yeah, if you're doing a shitting dog, it's a mistake.
Absolutely. And like, one of the things that kills me with sport training too is like, imagine the progress and momentum you carry if you dial in a technique, right? You got your athlete proficient. Let's just use squat because that's a good example that we've been working with. You got somebody who's really good at squats. You can take them through their entire fucking preparatory period and into their sporting period, where you say, okay, we're doing, you know, we're starting our GPP stuff. We're doing squats at like 8-ish, you know, plus or minus 8 reps for kind of work capacity hypertrophy. As we move down the line, now we're doing like 5 or 6. Now we're doing 3 to 4. Now we're doing 1 to 3. Like, you've been dialing in that technique for that amount of time under different loads. You're going to be strong as fuck, relatively speaking, by the time you get to that 1 to 3 stage, because you have been doing that same movement for so long. Is that necessarily the best way to grow muscle from a hypertrophy standpoint? No, but it's a really good way of movement training and getting strong as fuck in a certain movement. And that's going to have a lot of carryover in your sport practice. So there's kind of like a short-term versus long-term consideration there, where you might be like, okay, I do have an athlete that needs to gain a significant amount of muscle to become more competitive. And there's maybe some different strategies we use for this athlete. I have another athlete who is just doing kind of more vanilla training, and I'm going to keep that same movement in for as long as I can so that they make really tangible progress over the course of 6 months on this movement and get strong. And then after that one's kind of tapped out, maybe we do a new block at the end of the season. I might switch it out for like a front squat or something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's it's so important that like you just move so much better. And I think that like it also stops you from getting, you know, people that squat once a year for 4 weeks and then they complain that squatting hurts their knees every time they go back to it. It's like, well, yeah, you just haven't got good at the fucking movement. Yeah, I mean, it's just obvious. Speaking of injuries, I before I let you go, I do need to ask you, as you are pretty much known in RP circles as the recovery guy quite well, what are some of your biggest pet peeves when it comes to the idea of recovery?
Man, there's so many. Where do I even start?
I know.
Okay, so just off the top of my head, the ones that come up the most, I think, are like the Theragun gun. That drives me, you know, like the dildo gun.
Yeah.
Just like jabs mm-hmm. you over and mm-hmm. over again. That one gets used a lot. And people love to tote it as this big recovery thing. You got to recover your muscles, man. It just makes you feel like a little bit better, but it doesn't do anything. That one drives me absolutely bonkers. There is actually a good use for that. It's just not what people think it is. That's the funny part. Ice baths.
Proprioceptive thing for the gun?
It can be. The biggest use for like those kind of things is actually just eliciting like a very short-term flexibility mobility effect, mm-hmm. which is really fun. So yeah, so you can hit somebody on the hamstrings for like 5 minutes and then they can just hit like a greater range of motion in like a hip hinge movement for, you know,
we did it in my rugby days with a car buffer.
Oh yeah, there you go. Yeah. So my vibration also does the same thing, which is really funny. So if you have like a vibration platform, you can do the same effect actually. So that's what it's used for. That has a potential training use. It's just not good for recovery. It doesn't do anything for recovery. It just makes you feel like a little bit better, I guess.
It's a marketing thing again, I guess, right? Marketing ruins everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Use this thing, right? The ice baths one is drives me nuts for people, just constantly in and out of the ice bath, thinking that it's,
as time goes on, ice is getting like less and less efficacy for recovery. Like it's getting worse and worse and worse. Like first it was like you can use this and it's great, then it's like, oh, this, you can use this but it might actually impede what you're trying to do, and now it's like, ah, we don't even know if this does anything.
Yeah, I think there's like a distinct time to use the ice, and that's like when you are in season or you have multiple competitions in a short amount of time and you got pain that you're dealing with and you need to reduce the pain so that you can play at a high level.
But so pain, not just fatigue, right? It has to be something
not
that
fatigue.
You... Yep.
Not mm-hmm. fatigue. Yep.
Yeah.
So that's a good one. The drinks and stuff where it's like, check out this recovery drink. And you look at the food label, it has like 0 calories. You're like, how could this do anything?
Yes.
What is this?
Yeah.
No carbs, no protein, no calories, no nothing. Stupid. The one that's, this isn't so much a pet peeve, but like one that's been coming up lately is the infrared therapy. And that's one I don't really have a strong opinion on. I know a little bit about it. It seems to be used therapeutically, like meaning like when people have like injuries, and they're otherwise debilitated. I don't think that there's a strong use for that in like just kind of S&C and mm-hmm. fitness kind of stuff. I think it's probably better use for when people can't move as, you know, like they're injured mm-hmm. or they have some mm-hmm. kind of physical limitation where they can't move around. Whereas like if you can move around, doing the more traditional things like taking your light sessions and stuff like that's probably a much better way to go.
I want to reframe the question a little bit different now. I'm like, it's just more intrigued that you are the recovery guy, but why are people so interested in recovery? Like, because we've already sort of discussed here, it's a marketing thing more than anything else. But why is it a marketing thing? How has that become a goal that people seek? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm going to sound very cunty right now, but I think it's one of those things where it's marketed in such a way that it seems to be kind of like a life hack where people think like, if you do this, you can circumvent a lot of the bullshit that you don't want to do, right? Which is really not what it does at all. So it's like, you know, get this Theragun, use this massage technique, go in the ice bath and you'll have these great gains. No, you won't have great gains, right? You get great gains from great training and great lifestyle and behaviors and great nutrition. Those would get you great gains, right? Adding these other things might potentially help you get there a little bit, but that's not going to It's not going to circumvent doing the necessary evils, right? Like, that's the problem.
Yeah, I guess it's like supplements, you know? It's like, take this supplement. What's your diet like? Oh, it doesn't matter. It's like, do this recovery thing. Right. Oh, how many hours are you sleeping? 5. Like,
throw it out the window. Throw it in the fucking bin. That's the thing. Like, people drive me nuts with that kind of stuff. And it's, I don't blame them, because it's always marketed in such a way where it's like, have you been having shitty gains? Yeah, take this thing for mega dick gains. And you're like, okay, that sounds great. But it's always something stupid and just kitschy. And like, at the end of the day, you can't get around doing the basic stuff and doing the basic stuff well. And that's just something I wish I could just tell everybody. And that applies to almost everything in life, but particularly in the training and recovery realm, right? It's like, you know what you got to do. You know, if you got to get stronger, there's one path to getting stronger, and that's getting under some heavy load, right? Like, that's it. And then after that, you manage your nutrition, you manage your lifestyle, and you go from there. There's nothing that gets around those fundamental things.
And kind of like what we've already spoken about quite a lot here is like, it's systematizing your training. Like, the problem I see a lot is like, oh, they're looking to recover. And it's like, well, if you like,
recover from what?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Put your training load down first. Like, there's no recovery can't be a goal unless you've got the other specific goals that have put recovery to be there. Like, in which case you've got to take out the other stuff. Like, that would be the most obvious thing is figure out your training first. Like, if you can't tell me what you did for your training on Monday, then don't even think about doing anything else for recovery. There's no point.
So you're doing the steel man argument. I'm doing the straw man. Usually I get people who are like, I need more recovery. I'm like, oh yeah, what's your training look like? They're like, I train 3 times a week. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. You don't need recovery. You need training.
Yeah.
You're not training. Get out of here.
It's totally true. And but there's a reason for it. It's like, again, it was one of the first questions we spoke about here. It's like, doing this needs analysis is something that I'd say 90% of even the people that have gone out of their way to seek out to listen to the Robbie Muscle podcast still don't do, because it's a bit of a ball ache. But unfortunately, there's no hack around them. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, if you want to claim that you're doing evidence-based training, which is what most people I think should aspire to, part of that comes from collecting evidence, right? And that evidence is the data that you collect on yourself that helps guide the training decisions that you make. So if you're just winging it, which is okay, you can still wing it. It's just not evidence-based. You're just winging it, right? Evidence-based comes from the fact that you have looked at what you're doing. You look at, is this like, am I on the path to success or not, based on like the information that I have available, which is a combination of science and experience and anecdotes from other people. And I'm using all those things, looking at where I'm at, and I'm trying to create the trajectory to get me on the most efficacious path based on those things that I've collected. That's evidence-based practice right there.
Oh, I think we'll have to leave it there. That was about a perfect closing note from
Woo! David. A strong note.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I will obviously link the hypertrophy book and all your other books down below. I don't think you want people to follow you on Instagram. Do you yet?
You are welcome to follow me on Instagram. It's mostly just pictures of like me and my cats and my dogs and just doing Montana nonsense. A good place if you are interested in any of my wacky nonsense is the RP Weekly webinar on YouTube. So if you just type in Renaissance Periodization on YouTube, you can just subscribe. And Mike and I do a webinar every week where we answer top 10 questions.
Awesome. I'll link that in also below. Thank you so much. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, James, for coming on. We'll see you guys in the next one. All right. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed that episode of the Robbie Muscle Podcast, then I've got a quick little request and a potential prize giveaway for you if you do said request. All I want you to do is go to Apple Podcasts and type up a 5-star review. Just your general opinions of the podcast would be great feedback, but also helps us reach higher rankings, get more exposure, allow me to attract more guests and devote more time to developing a better all-around podcast experience for you. All you have to do, once again, is go and give us a 5-star review on whatever podcast service you use. Let me know that you've got it. And then every single week, I'll be selecting one review to give away a free prize. That free prize will be either 1 free month of Team Robbie Muscle. That's our world-class strength condition program app delivered directly to your phone. Or if that doesn't interest you, then we've got 1 free consultation where I'll go over your training program, your nutrition, and advise you how to best plan for your goals. Even if none of those things interest you, it's still doing me a solid and helping the podcast grow by going and giving us a 5-star review. There's no real excuse. It takes like 1 minute and that helps the show out exponentially. So I'd really appreciate it if you could do that. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you in the next one.